Hello, I am Randy Andrews, and today I've got Darren and Ruth Sutherland on from the Rad Adventure Network, and we're going to discuss one of their favorite movies, as well as mine, The Princess Bride. We'll be discussing the cast, the background, some of the comedic outtakes of the film, and the wonderful set designs, and of course, the score from the film. It's all today on Soundtrack Alley. Andrews, Darren, Ruth, it's good to have you on my show again.
Oh, thanks so much. We're glad to be back.
Always enjoy being on your show, Randy.
Yeah. So what are your initial thoughts on The Princess Bride?
It is a wonderful classic and my all-time favorite. So my initial thoughts are this is just my kind of movie. There's adventure, there's true love, there's comedy. It has it all.
And I agree. I love this movie too. It may not be my all-time favorite, but it's in my all-time top five, I would say. Absolutely love it. We've seen it more times than either one of us could count. It's always enjoyable.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such a good movie. There's so many. It's probably one of the most quotable movies.
Yes.
this morning at my job, I was talking to one of my workmates and we were quoting The Princess Bride back and forth.
Oh, so much fun.
So, yeah, it was a blast.
We've been lucky to see it a couple of times at screenings with an audience. And so often, you know, you see it with an audience and they're quoting right along with it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no one needs the words up on screen like some movies do. It's just everybody knows the lines.
Yeah, yeah. So let's get into talking about a little bit about the cast.
I can't compete with you physically, and you're no match for my brains.
You're that smart.
Let me put it this way. Have you ever heard of Plato, Aristotle, Socrates?
Yes.
Morons.
Really?
So, during some of the filming of some of the scenes, now, a lot of the weather was somewhat cold in the area that they were filming for Robin Wright. And so Andre the Giant, he had helped her by placing one of his hands over her head. And wow. His hands were so large that it would entirely cover the top of her head, keeping her warm.
Amazing.
Yeah. I mean, he's such a large guy.
Yes.
And one of the things that I recall from recording a previous episode about Conan the Destroyer, that he was the like monster in that film. And then Wilt Chamberlain was also a very tall guy.
Yes.
But Andre the Giant was still like a little taller. Than him. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Massive.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
He was truly a giant.
Yes.
So it was interesting when asked about his favorite thing about making the movie, Andre the Giant replied, without skipping a beat, nobody looks at me. And he felt treated as an equal without people staring at him because of his grand height. I thought that was
That's great.
That's fabulous.
Yeah. When it was interesting when Count Rugen hits Wesley over the head, Cary Elwes told Christopher Guest to go ahead and hit him for real. And Guest hit him hard enough to shut down production for a day while Elwes went to the hospital for that.
Yikes.
When we watched the movie, that's Ruth always says, he really got hit there.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, that wasn't acting. It was true.
Yeah. And that was the case also with the scene with the sword fight. where Mandy, what is his name?
Mandy Patinkin.
Patinkin. He got hit on the head, really. They couldn't afford fake stores, but they could afford real ones.
Yes.
That was what was really puzzling by that. So, and I really like that Rob Reiner directed this film.
Oh, and absolutely.
Yes.
He made it like a callback to the classic Robin Hood of the 30s and 40s, or the Errol Flynn type adventures.
And, exactly, the swashbuckler feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's certainly Cary Elwes was so good in that role that, and he looks a lot like Errol Flynn there, which of course is then why Mel Brooks turned around and cast him as Robin Hood later on in another movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, this is something that we always found interesting. Rob Reiner has been a fan of this book since before it was ever published, because his dad, Carl Reiner, knew William Goldman, and William Goldman gave Carl Reiner the book to proofread before it was ever published.
Oh, nice.
So Rob Reiner had read it and was a fan of it before it even came out. So it's wonderful that he got to do the movie. Absolutely.
In fact, with that fact known, since it is the 25th, well, with the 25th anniversary edition of the DVD that came mm-hmm. out, and I think it's also on Blu-ray now, there was a Target exclusive of a hardcover leather-bound copy of The Princess Bride that came along, or that you can buy separately, and it's like $25.
Oh, wow.
Oh, terrific.
you can find it on like target.com or something, but it's like, that's really cool. And the cover looks amazing. And
oh, that sounds like, special.
Yeah. Nice.
Ruth would be just, going to target.com right away, I'm sure.
I know someone that has the book.
Uh-huh.
And they were showing me pictures of it, and I'm like, oh my goodness, this looks amazing. So, real big fan of the book. Have you read the book?
Mm-hmm.
Definitely read the book, and I have also heard the audio adaptation, the audio book.
Nice. Yeah, Rob Reiner reads the audio adaptation of it too.
Oh, cool. Yeah. That's really cool. Yeah. I never thought that he would do any audio narration.
He does. It's his favorite book, so he had a great time with it. He does amazing voices, and his acting skills shine through in the book. It's fun.
Nice. That's fantastic. So let's veer back a little bit for Andre the Giant for one little point. It's really unique because he called everyone on the set, which they could be a director, producer, a co-star, a member of the crew, but he would always call them boss. He employed to defer to people he liked and go some way towards counteracting the idea that he would tower over them. I thought that was just really cool.
Clever.
And it made him like that much seem more humble, and he just seems like a really down-to-earth guy.
I mean
he did.
Mm-hmm.
So his personality just comes through in this role. It's just wonderful, and it's great that he got to see how popular this movie became before he sadly passed away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So with Robin Wright and Cary Elwes, they were smitten with each other during the filming, and naturally it was helping their chemistry in the movie. And so Elwes said that he couldn't concentrate on much of anything after that first encounter with her.
Oh, sweet. That's very complimentary.
I thought that was really cool. And they were also so reluctant to end their time on that film that during their final shared scene, the horseback kiss, one or the other of them would keep requesting another take for all sorts of made-up reasons. I thought that was cool.
And they both seemed to, they've both done so many other things, but they both seemed to love this film. They love reminiscing about it and talking about it. Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah. Also, it was interesting that, each time the grandfather would be telling the story and the grandson would make up some comment about not the kissing again. But then when Buttercup finally finds Wesley lying on her bed, she jumps on top of him and kisses him, and he doesn't make any comment for it. It's just really funny. Did you also know that Courtney Cox and even Meg Ryan auditioned for this role for Buttercup?
I do know that a lot of people had to go through screen tests because they were really looking for a certain type of actress and accent and portrayal on the screen. So, but I had not heard about those two in particular, and that would have made an entirely different type of Buttercup with either one of them.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Yeah, I remember hearing Rob Reiner say, I don't remember now how many hundreds of actresses he screen tested for Buttercup. And he just, it was down to like very close to the time to start filming before finally Robin Wright came in and he was just like, oh, finally, this, she's perfect. I'm glad I waited.
That's awesome. Yeah. I thought it was also interesting that Robin Wright at the time had been a soap opera star.
Yes.
You know any further information on that?
I think just maybe the name of the show was at Santa Barbara.
Yeah, and I think she had to get, like, she was still under contract, so she had to extend her contract on that show by another year in order for them to give her time off to make this movie.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So maybe she was out of the country during that soap opera.
So, yeah, I guess
they probably in the storyline had something dramatic happen to the character where she's in a coma or, you know, lost somewhere and then eventually got to come back and make a grand entrance.
Yeah.
We've never seen it, but we'd heard that story.
Yeah. It was interesting that Fred Savage never actually got to meet Cary Elwes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, why wouldn't they ever meet? You know, I mean,
the timing.
But yeah.
It's that's really an interesting part of the story. We've heard Fred Savage talk about that, where the scenes of Helm and Peter Falk were all filmed after all the rest of the film was complete. So when they arrived, everyone else was gone. But Fred Savage said that he was so thankful that all the sets were still there. So they would film during the day and then he would spend the evenings wandering around the sets. Nice. So at least he got to see all of that.
Yeah, and he was able to more or less visualize what was going on in the scenes and everything. And that's really cool.
It was magical.
And he was such a big star at that point in time. We were watching him on Wonder Years all the time, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, what do you think of Mandy Patinkin?
Mandy Patinkin.
Patinkin, yeah.
His performance is stellar, really. There's so much depth and so much scope in what he was able to portray on the screen, from humor to pain to loss, distress, just so much.
Oh, he's fabulous in this role. And, you know, for anyone, you know, get a copy of the DVD or Blu-ray to watch some of his interviews. He loves this film so much that he's just like a fan when he talks about it. And he will cry talking about this movie because he loves it so much. And we've heard him say how he's just, you know, thankful he'll be remembered by this movie. And that's just a wonderful thing for him.
And did you know some of the background on why he wanted to be cast in this film so much?
Tell us.
All right. So his father had just died of cancer before the movie was even filmed. And so he went for the audition. And when he was doing his scenes, it meant so much to him. The character, he connected really with the character because of the loss the character had went through with his father. Then it meant so much to him even at the end where he was finding Count Rugen. And that it was almost really emotional for him that he was like, he was fighting the cancer that his father had battled with. And so you could really see, like, it was almost true anger that he was displaying in the film, you know, toward the end because of what he had lost with his own dad. So
that's an awesome story.
I thought that was a really unique story that I had found on like an interview, or I don't remember where I found it, but I included it in my notes.
Nice.
To be able to know that that was a real background for him, that he was really going for this role because it meant so much to him.
Sure.
Well, he did an amazing job with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, he really did. He also had said that the only injury that he sustained during the entire filming was a bruised rib due to the stifling of the laughter in the scenes with because his attempt at holding back his laughter is obvious in his facial expression during his line that says, "This is noble, sir." And everybody who's even seen The Princess Bride can remember that scene. So.
Right.
I thought it was just really a lot of fun. And Billy Crystal was great in that.
Oh, Billy Crystal's fabulous in this.
We've heard that Rob Reiner and Cary Elwes actually had to get off of the set because they were laughing too much and too loudly, that it was spoiling some of the takes.
Yeah. And we've heard Billy Crystal say that of all the movies he's ever made, including movies that he was the star of, this is his favorite film and his favorite character. And if you see him out in public, if you say, "Have fun storming the castle," he'll give you an autograph.
Oh, nice. Yeah. That's really awesome. And then also, it was interesting, Mel Smith played the albino. Now, he confessed never having watched his performance due to the painful experience involved in filming that role. Now, his character required him to wear colored contact lenses, and unknown to Smith that the costume department at the time, he was actually allergic to the lens solution used. And so this meant that he was in constant pain and discomfort throughout the filming. And so thus he's reluctant to relive that memory of the character, but he really did play the role well.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
So
they got some wonderful, you know, classic British comedians and to do cameos in that film. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's get into some of the background on these cast of characters and then just on the film itself.
In that case, I challenge you to a battle of wits.
For the princess? To the death? I accept.
Good. Then pour the wine.
So, despite Fezzik's almost superhuman strength, he had back problems that at the time prevented him from actually lifting anything heavy. Mm-hmm. And so Robin Wright had to be attached to wires in the scene where Buttercup jumps from the castle window into Fezzik's arms because he couldn't support her himself.
Right.
I found that really interesting.
Yeah, he had had back surgery just shortly before the filming, and he could not carry any weight at all. So it's like the scenes when he's fighting Wesley and Wesley's on his back. It's actually, there's a series of wooden posts in irregular shapes out of screenshot that Cary Elwes is standing on and walking around on the whole time that he's supposedly on his back. And then when you see from a distance, when Cary Elwes is on Fezzik's back, it's not really Andre the Giant. You can tell it's someone with a mask on if you look really closely.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, it's a real shame that, you know, they hired him for that, and yet he was going through a lot of pain during the course of the film, which is, again, it's amazing how charming he is in the film.
Yeah, yeah. And then another thing about Andre the Giant was he needed an ATV to get him to shooting locations. he was always trying to get Cary Elwes to drive it, and Elwes eventually relented, but on his first time driving it, he hit a patch of rocks as he was shifting gears, which caused his foot to slip from the clutch, and eventually became wedged between the pedal and a rock, and his left big toe was bent straight down and was broken, and he tried to conceal it from Rob Reiner, and eventually he had to confess, and they worked shooting around his swollen toe and limb, and you can notice it in a scene right before Buttercup pushes him down the hill. that he sits down with his leg extended because he wasn't able to put weight on the foot. And in the next scene, when he and Buttercup head into the fire swamp, he has a strange hop in his step. So that might be why. And then, like Billy Crystal, he used his Saturday Night Live makeup artist, Peter Montega, to create Miracle Max. I thought that was kind of cool because of his connection to Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. And Billy brought him photos of his grandmother and Casey Stengel to help develop the look, and also brought in an uncle who had similar bone structure to that. So I thought that was really cool. It was a neat little tidbit that I learned about him.
Yeah, he really thought that out.
Yeah, and it looks really good.
Yeah. Now, one of the scenes I really enjoy talking about is the sword fight scene. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of the favorite scenes and favorite sword fights of movie history.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
Like, you can go on YouTube and look at different videos of top 10 sword fights or whatever, you know, and Princess Bride always makes the list because of that one sword fight. And it's just, it's really well done because they spent so many hours training to be able to know how to sword fight. And according to Rob Reiner, the only stunt performed by Patinkin's stunt double was the one flip during the chatty duelist scene. So I thought that was kind of cool.
It's a spectacular sword fight.
Yeah, easily the best ever, I think, on film. And yeah, we had heard that the two of them had to train 8 to 10 hours a day for months prior to the start of filming. And then once filming started, they insisted that every free moment they had, they were practicing more. So yeah, they're it's an amazing sword fight. And of course, we were talking about Errol Flynn earlier, and one of the stunt coordinators was the person who taught Errol Flynn how to sword fight. Mm-hmm. And one of the other ones was the body double for David Prowse that played Darth Vader.
Oh, nice.
His lightsaber duels.
That's so, pretty awesome.
Great pedigree.
That's really good. Did you know that writer William Goldman actually was on set during the flame burst scenes in the forest when Robin Wright's dress caught on fire? Now, although Goldman knew this was intentional, he was so caught up in the moment that he said, "Her dress is on fire." And it ruined the take for that scene. I thought that was hilarious. Fire!
So, that's a great story.
I thought that was really neat. And then according to him, that when he was first trying to get the movie made in the 70s, Arnold Schwarzenegger wanted to play Fezzik because he was strongly being considered because Goldman could never get his first choice, which was Andre the Giant, to read for the role. And by the time the movie was made, about 12 years later, Schwarzenegger was such a big star that they couldn't even afford him. Hmm. And so Andre was cast after all, and the two big men had gone on to become close friends. I thought that was really cool.
Very nice.
So, and then another thing about Andre the Giant scenes on tape, that with Rob doing Andre's lines during rehearsal, Andre would walk around with headphones with the tape playing all the time. And so it worked great. And they didn't even need to loop any of his lines because he eventually would just memorize his lines by listening to that tape that Rob Reiner had made for him. So I thought that was really cool.
That is excellent, because English wasn't his first language, and that was definitely a concern he had about how he was going to sound and how he would be able to do those lines. So it seems like they came up with a perfect solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, what do you think of the locations that were used?
Oh, they're gorgeous. I want to go visit them all. I understand the Cliffs of Insanity are on the western coast of Ireland. Mm-hmm. And the castle is there somewhere in England. I should track it down someday.
Yeah. Haddon Hall. Is that the name of it?
I think so.
Haddon Hall. Yeah. It's like, you can visit it.
Most of the movie was filmed in England, and the castle was, Haddon Hall. and it was a fortified country house. So that was interesting. And it dates to before 1087.
Wow. A long time ago.
It was listed in the Domesday Book. And the tapestries are original, and it dates back to the late medieval and Renaissance periods. So I thought that was pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And it's like the detail inside the castle is really authentic and just, you know, makes you feel like you're right there.
That you're that it's all real. Yeah, you get that feeling of something majestic.
Mm-hmm. And even the echo, like you can hear the echo, like when Prince Humperdinck's father is walking Buttercup to her chambers, you can hear her heels clicking on the stone, and it's like, wow, that's really actually very impressive to, you know, hear those noises inside that castle. And, you know, even though, you know, they're filming a, you know, pretty high production movie and everything, but still it makes it more authentic and real to actually hear those noises in the background. I like that.
Yes.
So let's see. There were no shrieking eels in the book, of course. And it just was interesting that once Buttercup jumps overboard to escape her captors, Vicini warns her of the sharks in the water and fills a cup with her own blood and throws it in the water to attract them. And that was an interesting twist and, you know, different take in the book that, yeah, that would make sense that there would be sharks in the water. So, I like
the shrieking eels are a nice change.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay. Let's see. Did you know that the Dread Pirate Roberts was actually a real pirate?
Oh, tell us more.
Well, first of all, his costume was modeled after the infamous vigilante Zorro, leaving out the cape. But then later on, like as I was doing my research, the real Dread Pirate Roberts was named Bartholomew Roberts, and he was also known as Black Bart, who operated in the Caribbean in the early 18th century. And he was reckoned by many to have been one of the most successful pirates of the time. And I believe his story is also in a book on like famous pirates. I'm not sure what the exact title is, but you can probably find it. It has on the cover of the book, it has a picture of a skull and sword blades behind it. And, or unless it's crossbones, I'm not really sure. But it's a really interesting book. I have it on Kindle, and I have yet to read it. But it talks about a lot of the famous pirates that actually existed. And he was one of them. And I thought that was so cool. So,
I'm glad you brought that up, Randy. It reminds me, I'm trying to remember. I think, is there a little like quasi-parody documentary that Cary Elwes did that we saw sometime where he's pretending
extra.
He's pretending to be a like Oxford University historian or professor or something like that. And he's analyzing whether or not the Dread Pirate Roberts really existed. And I think Randy, you saying that reminded me, I think that's one of the different pirates that he talks about. So yeah, nice. It's a funny thing that he did. I remember. Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I found that really unique and something that I really wanted to bring out because I was like, I have to find that. And I thought it was neat that, you know, like Vicini, who was Wallace Shawn, he tells the man in black, never go up against a Sicilian when death is on the line. And Vicini is the name of a small town in Sicily.
Perfect.
So it's just perfect for his role. And he even had this advice to not get involved in a land war in Asia. And it's derived from principles stated by Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery, which is Viscount Alamein, in a speech in the House of Lords on May the 30th, 1962, where it says, Rule 1 on page 1 of the Book of War is do not march on Moscow. Rule 2 is do not go fighting in your land armies in China. So I thought that was really interesting. Oh, and then you know how there were two kingdoms, Florin and Gilder?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, these are names of former Dutch currencies.
Yes.
Which is the Florin and the Gulden, or the Gulden, I guess. G-U-L-D-E-N. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I found that interesting too.
Yeah, that's really neat. And I wanted to step back just a moment to Wallace Shawn, because Wallace Shawn is so good as Vizzini. And it's funny, we heard in an interview Rob Reiner talking once about how Wallace Shawn was so afraid he was going to get fired from the production if Rob Reiner found out he wasn't really from Sicily. So he kept trying to practice on his accent. And when he finally confessed it to Rob Reiner, Rob Reiner said, I knew all along you weren't from Sicily.
He was also really concerned that he was going to lose the role because the other consideration was Danny DeVito. And he became convinced that he was like wrong for the role and that he was in danger of being fired, and he was super nervous, and he was visibly sweating during the scene of the Battle of Wits. And like you had said, you know, he just he was like, I'm not from
Well, he did a great job. Such a memorable performance.
We were lucky. He came to Dragon Con this past year, so we got to meet him just this past year. And he looks still just like himself 30 years later, you know. And he was so funny and playful, enjoyed talking about the film. So it's nice.
Nice. That would have been really cool.
Yeah.
Were you able to get a picture with him? Or
we did.
We did, yes.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
It's a rare thing to sometimes get a picture with a famous actor that you really find, you know, can connect with.
Absolutely.
You absolutely love. Like, it was a real treat for me that I got to meet Walter Koenig.
Oh, yes.
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 So he's really nice to meet, and he's with a lot of fun. So yeah,
great. Absolutely great.
Not to get off on topic or anything, but that was a lot of fun. I like how when Inigo says, I'm not budging, keep your hoe there, to the brute of the brute squad, he's actually insulting the man by cross language pun, which is Joder, and it's pronounced similarly to ho there, and it's a Spanish obscenity, which I didn't know.
Oh, I didn't know
before that. So all the main characters even are introduced in the first 7 minutes of the film.
Oh, wow.
So that was really interesting. And then, did you ever wonder where they got the video game for the grandson's
the opening scene?
It's actually called Hardball, and sometimes it's really neat to find some of these video game connections. In my Buckaroo Banzai episode, there was a video game connection, and it was found on several different consoles. And this one, it was only on the Commodore 64, and it was, of course, in the 1980s, and it was a 1-to-2-player game, and the sound was not actually from the actual game, but it was added later.
Okay.
Actually just say, oh yeah, we're gonna actually put this in here. So
they do a good job with those sound effects. That opening scene makes people laugh, you know, as soon as it comes on, so you're in the mood for the film and that opening few sounds.
Yeah, exactly. And then the ROUSs are actually referenced in several video games as well, such as Borderlands 2, Fallout New Vegas, and World of Warcraft Legion. So I didn't even know that. And I sometimes like to bring out those video game references, because once in a while I'm able to interview a video game composer,
right,
or include some little factoids about video game of this movie. And I think anybody can also attest to the heinous act of them creating the video game for E.T., the extraterrestrial.
Oh, yeah, the one they buried in the desert.
Oh, and then I thought this was really interesting that on the DVD scene menu for the Pit of Despair scene, it's referred to the Pit of Desire.
Oh.
So I thought that was really interesting.
Somebody didn't check their spelling.
Yeah, exactly. And then although the film was set in a fantasy world, the mention of criminals being brought or being sent to Australia means that the year is set after 1788.
Hmm.
So that must have been a thing that actually happened after that time period. So I didn't know that either. Oh, Rob Reiner was actually the voice of the ROUSs.
Perfect.
So I didn't know that either. For the Canadian fans, Peter Falk reads to Fred Savage, and he's drinking from a Hudson's Bay of Canada mug. Mm. So I thought that was kind of cool. And referencing The Criminals, the story of it would take place after Captain Cook's discovery of Australia. And then it was followed by the first arrival of British convicts in 1778. So that was really interesting.
Just you mentioning Peter Falk reminds me, I think that we heard a story that Peter Falk is the one that made them put gray powder in his hair because he didn't think he looked old enough to be a grandfather at the time they made the film. Rob Reiner didn't have the heart to tell him, yes, you do.
Well, I don't know. Peter Falk, he kept his hair for quite a while. I mean, even not having gray hair for quite a while because of, you know, all that he's done. So
he looked great. We love him as Columbo, but it's just it's funny that's what he felt, though. He didn't look old enough to be a grandfather. So yeah. Put some gray in my hair.
So what do you think of Buttercup, or I should say Robin Wright, that, you know, there's been many instances where she referred to this movie. And in the movie itself, there's only a couple scenes where she's actually referred to as Buttercup, but mostly it's the princess. Mm-hmm. Like, she's just referred to as the princess. And the grandfather states that Buttercup was born on a small farm, and that Humperdinck states in his speech that she was once a commoner. And the reason for the discrepancy is that in the novel, the law of the land did indeed allow Humperdinck to choose his bride, but the bride was required to be a princess. And so Humperdinck overcame the obstacle by making Buttercup princess of a non-existent country, making her eligible to marry him. So I thought,
there you go. Leave it to him to find a loophole.
Yeah, exactly. And he was perfect for that role.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, well, let's now get into some of the soundtrack portion. What do you find most appealing to you about the soundtrack?
I would say the variety, and there's a variety of instruments, a variety of approaches to the songs, and definitely it does an excellent job in evoking different emotions, from, you know, the right kind of music to accompany a sword fight, to a friendly scene between Fezzik and Inigo, to, you know, something that's humorous. So just a grand scope for it.
Yeah, that's exactly what I would say. The variety in the soundtrack is just amazing because it's light and it's playful, but it's dark when it needs to be, and it booming majesty when it needs to be for like some of those wonderful vistas that they show, or climbing up the cliffs of insanity or something like that. So just a great variety to the soundtrack. You know, sometimes you listen to a soundtrack separately. And, you know, there's just a couple of little themes. And then most of the music in between is just sort of incidental quiet underneath the dialogue. But this film, it really, you know, listening to the soundtrack is entertaining. It's just ebbs and flows and crescendos and slows down. It's nice.
Yeah. So when you're really crafting like a fantasy film and having it go for a movie that has kind of a dreamlike quality, that The Princess Bride almost feels like a dream in a way. And you need music that really transports you to that same place where the visuals do. And so Mark Knopfler, he was the right man for the job. And he was famously the frontman and lead guitarist for Dire Straits. Uh-huh. And he wasn't a stranger to composing film because he did scores for Cal and Local Hero, which
is a favorite film of ours.
I haven't seen it. Jerry Green keeps telling me that I should see it.
Oh, and well, I will second Jerry Green on that. We're huge fans of Bill Forsyth's film, any of his films. I saw Gregory's Girl when it first came out, and it was magical. And then I introduced Ruth to it, and we've watched every Bill Forsyth film that we ever can, all the way up to Gregory's Two Girls that he made 20 years after Gregory's Girl. So
nice. Yeah. Nice. And one of the things that I really like about it is that he would go on to compose for several more, including like the Dustin Hoffman, Robert De Niro, Wag the Dog. And then it really takes a gentleman to have this kind of musical knowledge and experience and versatility to bring to The Princess Bride the effort of a unique and magical touch that it really needed. If you pay attention to the score, it's really unique in a way that it's sometimes it's like background music, but you can almost swear that there's a small band of traveling musicians on lutes and harpsichords that provide this ambience that we, as we make our way to through the fictional land of Florin, and it fits so naturally that it's almost difficult to really think about not traveling without a harpsichord. And
I like your analogy there, Randy. That's a really fun way of thinking about it. And it also makes me think of Monty Python's The Holy Grail. It's like one of the knights travels with his own minstrel band that plays along as he travels. So that's a perfect connection.
Yeah. And I really like also from the spooky spine tingling tune that plays during the climbing of the cliffs of insanity to the frenetic anxiety-induced music that scores for the sword fight, and then to the sweet and perfect notes that are used to enhance the moments of tenderness between Wesley and Buttercup. And they all hit their right mark. Mm-hmm. And I really find that The Princess Bride is like a modern classic because it's just timeless and it's included in so much. And the score, even though it's entirely synthesized, which I didn't realize before doing my research on that, and the only live instruments that were being used were guitar and the bass and percussion. Now, these were performed, the guitar was performed by Knopfler, and then the bass was by Mickey Feet, and then the percussion was by Errol Bennett and Jamie Lane. And so the main theme, which is heard throughout the score, isn't even Knopfler. And it's actually by Willie DeVille, whose original song, Storybook Love, was nominated for an Academy Award in 1987. Mm-hmm. So I really like that.
Yeah, and it's then, a beautiful song.
Yeah, it really is. And DeVille's theme is that melodic heart of the score. And it's highlighted throughout with this beautifully rendered guitar solos that Knopfler does so well, like with the opening cue of Once Upon a Time and Storybook Love, and then like I Will Never Love Again. And you get like a complete opposite of what, you know, you have this melodic, wonderful, light and airy piece. And then with I Will Never Love Again, it's actually a very melancholy and not really depressing, but it's just, sad. It's more emotional. Mm-hmm. And I really find that unique. And then like the Fire Swamp, that it clearly acknowledges that the movie has this quirky humor, but it also acknowledges that there's these moments of deep action and tenseness and surprise. And you can really see how the movie plays like a fairy tale.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So with Knopfler's style, along not only this score, but throughout his other scores, it's a distinctive extension of that instrumental backing of his pop songs. And it's nearly impossible to compare with any other film score. And that's something that I really found unique for this score, is that it stands on its own. Yes. And it reminds me of when we were talking about Lady Hawk.
Oh, yes.
That Lady Hawk stands on its own. Mm-hmm. And there's been a couple times when people have, you know, argued whether or not that should be rescored. If you check out Alexander Schiebel's YouTube channel, he's been doing some alternate takes on some of that scoring. So people can check that out at a later time. one of the really unique things I liked about the score, once again, before talking about some of the cues that I'll play, is the keyboarding of The Morning Ride and The Friend's Song, and then even Guide My Sword, that it often has this overwhelming soundscape with the gleaming major key goodness. And it's a film score that's easily listenable. Mm-hmm. Time and time again, right, because you can just have it on repeat and just continue to listen to it. So
it's a timeless score. I mean, we talked about that when we talked about Lady Hawk. The score for Lady Hawk dates that movie. The score for Princess Bride is a timeless score, so it doesn't date the film at all. I mean, you have Storybook Love, the vocals of Storybook Love, but it's not done in any distinct style from any particular decade. So it really, the movie soundtrack sounds fresh all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think, Ruth?
I agree. And when I listen to the soundtrack, I instantly visualize the scenes. So the music is so complimentary and tied into, you know, what goes on the screen. So I really do enjoy it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really find that to be true too, because, you know, when you listen to a film score, you want it to transport you to the place that it is in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can remember scene by scene by the music, that's pretty impressive work.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That the person that composes the music for that movie has the ability to make the score so memorable that all you need is thinking of the movie scenes in your head. Mm-hmm. When you hear that music. So I really enjoy that.
Yeah, quite effective.
Yeah. So I'll be playing a few of the cues from the film today. The first I'll play is Once Upon a Time in Storybook Love. And then I'll play Floor and Dance and then The Friend Song.
Mm.
Now, I find these cues to be irreplaceable and completely influential into the setting of this film. Now, Darren and Ruth, what are your thoughts on these cues?
So I'll share a couple of thoughts about the opening Once Upon a Time story. One thing I noticed in watching it through again recently is that the acoustic guitar starts out softly, which I think also parallels how Buttercup is not noticing yet that the farm boy is in love with her. But once she starts to notice that, the music swells up and gets louder. So I think it kind of parallels her observation of the love and also her falling in love. It's quite effective.
Yeah, and you chose some really great cues there, Randy, as well, because the Florin dance is just lots of fun. It's fun and playful. You know, it has that English sort of Morris folk dance sound to it. And it seems so light and playful. And yet at the same time, it's playing as they're introducing us to the bad guy in the film. So it's a really interesting counterpoint. It's like you're hearing this fun, playful music, and yet you're meeting the bad guy. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. And then the friend song. The friend song is, it stands so unique. It's kind of a short cue, but it's so beautiful. Mm-hmm. And it's so simple. The guitar work in it is just fantastic. And it's like any person could just pick up a guitar. I mean, if, like myself, if I knew how to play a guitar, I would probably be playing it all the time. But, you know, you think about that and how simple those notes are and how enjoyable it can be.
It's a wonderful sort of swinging, playful song, and you get the feel that two friends are having fun together while that's playing, and that's exactly what's going on screen at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now let's go ahead and play those cues. All right, so next, I'll be playing two cues from kind of the middle of the film, and it gives us kind of our essential action for the story. So I'll play the sword fight, and then the fire swamp and the rodents of unusual size. Now, these really give us some unique action for the movie, and even give us those little moments of fun to create this fantasy mood, as well as not only for the film, but also for the audience. What do you think of those?
Well, I want to say about the sword fight that I've noticed that there's a variety of pacing or rhythm, which I think changes up a lot, similar to the way the two fighters are finding their footing and changing their paces. So I think they're very complementary. And I like that there's a variety of instruments used. Like I listen closely and I hear some other wooden percussion sounds, castanets, violins, just such variety, just like they're using a lot of variety of sword fighting techniques. I think there's different music techniques going along there.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And I like the flourish at the end, just like he flourishes his sword. And then the next cue you were talking about, Randy, the nice thing with that one, the fire swamp and the rodents of unusual size, is it has very distinct pieces within it that are just perfect for the distinct challenges within the fire swamp, the fire spurts and the lightning sand and the rodents of unusual size. They each have their own distinct part of that music that just really brings each one of those sections alive.
And I really thought about that too, is that each part of that piece of music has like similar almost sound effects that are incorporated into the music in a way because of like what is happening in each scene, like with the fire spurts or with the sand, you hear kind of a maraca type sound effect that incorporates it as a sand sound. And I just found that to be brilliant.
Yes.
Because it fits so well with the movie, and then they don't actually have to necessarily have that sound in the movie, they can use it through the score. So really enjoy that.
Brilliant observations. Great pieces of music.
Yeah. So now I'll play those cues.
Thank you.
So sadly, we've come down to another end of Soundtrack Alley. I want to thank Alexander Shebell for the Soundtrack Alley theme music, and you can find his work at xanderscores.com. So today, lastly, I'll be playing Revenge and Happy Ending. How did these cues really tie up the movie?
So the nice thing about Revenge is it, again, sort of like what we were saying with the earlier sword fight between Wesley and Inigo. In this one, the speed of the music changes frequently, and it feels just like a chase, just like the chase that we're seeing on screen as the speed of the music changes as the two characters race through the castle. And then it gets punctuated by short blasts on the horns as the swords hit. It's just really a fun piece of music.
Mm-hmm. And then wrapping up the movie, which I'm always sad to see it come to a close, starts with the Friends song and the showing that the group of friends has expanded. And I love the beautiful sound of the harp as Buttercup jumps out of the window into Fezzik's arms. So it's just so, so beautiful to see and to hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and then it transitions into Buttercup's theme, which is gorgeous.
Yeah, yeah. And we get that reintroduction to that very theme from, like, say, the beginning of the movie.
From Storybook Love, absolutely.
Yeah. Ruth and Darren, where can people find you?
Well, thank you very much, Randy, for asking. First off, before we jump into us, I just want to second something you were just saying about Xander Score's website, because we've come to know his music thanks to your show, and it's fabulous. And we've been visiting his website. We follow him on Twitter now. It's such great stuff. So you have a wonderful theme. And then for people that want to follow us, so we've got some wonderful little websites, but I would say always you can consider starting at radadventuresnetwork.com. If you go there, you'll find all the episodes of all of our shows. And what are some of those shows, Ruth?
Well, we have Trekker Talk, which is about 23rd century bounty hunter Mercy St. Clair.
No,
you go ahead.
No, go on.
I was just going to add that Trekker is by Ron Randall, and he's one of our favorite artists, so check out his work.
And Xenozoic Xenophiles, about the Cadillacs and Dinosaurs series Xenozoic Tales by Mark Schultz.
And then Warlord Worlds, we get to talk about the works of Mike Grill, and that includes The Warlord, John Sable, Green Arrow, and the Legion of Superheroes.
Yeah, that's right. And we have Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr pages for everything. We have iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher. So please come and listen to our shows. We'd love to hear from anyone.
Yeah, and you also have that brand new one, which is...
Sensational Sleuths.
Yes, we love mystery stories. So we have just started Sensational Sleuths. One episode's out so far about Sherlock Holmes. Thank you very much, Randy.
Yeah, not a problem. So I want to really thank you guys for being on the show. It's always a pleasure to have your insight and to have the conversation, because it makes the show so much more lively and to be able to include your comments. So
it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Randy. You do a great show. You do two great shows. So we're happy to join you. Thank you much for the invitation.
Yeah, not a problem. And of course you can find me on soundtrackalley.net, soundtrackalley.podbean.com. I'm now on Stitcher, so you can search for me at Soundtrack Alley. You can find me, of course, on iTunes and Facebook, and on Twitter I'm at RandallAndrews1. And I believe that's it for now, except for that I also have a comic book podcast called The Gen 13 Files. And it's about the group of superhero teenagers known as Gen 13. And it includes five different teenagers and their powers and their challenges that they face. And so I've got about three episodes up already. So you can enjoy that as well.
It's so fun.
Yes.
I like doing it. So it's enjoyable to do. Until next time, I'll be playing these cues to end our show, and happy listening. Thank you for listening to Soundtrack Alley, the podcast. I hope you take the time to review my podcast on iTunes or even listen to it on Podbean. With your review, it helps me get noticed on iTunes. Thank you so much. Have a good day. Thank you for listening to Soundtrack Alley Spotlight. If you are on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review the show. Also, if you want to leave a comment, question, or concern, please email me at soundtrackalley@gmail.com and enjoy looking at my blog at soundtrackalley.com.